from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, is French really the language of love? Stanford scholar Marilyn Yalom explores the topic in her latest book, How the French Invented Love. Part memoir and part literary history, Marilyn Yalom discusses in the book why the French have championed themselves as the ultimate experts in love for centuries and how they've kept the flames of romance burning right up to the present day. She'll join us next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of our Forum program. Oh, how the French love love! So Stanford scholar and Bay Area author Marilyn Yalom exclaims in her newest work, How the French Invented Love, an ambitious book focusing on sex, love, and romance French style, going back nearly 1,000 years and up to the present day. Marilyn Yalom is a former professor of French, presently a senior scholar at the Clayman Institute for Gender Research at Stanford University. She's also the author of many books, including A History of the Breast, A History of the Wife, Birth of the Chess Queen, and The American Resting Place, 400 Years of History Through Our Cemeteries and Burial Grounds, which includes photographs by her son, Reed Yalom. Marilyn Yalom joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. And I realized I think we've done all of your books.
Well, quite a few. Thank you, Michael.
At least the four I mentioned. And good to have you back on Forum. Welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Well, this, as I said, I mean, ambitious doesn't even really serve us in talking, because you go all the way back to the 12th century and to William the Ninth, Duke of Aquitaine, and troubadour lyrics and minstrels and all that. And some would say the connection between all of that, going back that far, and the present day, and thinking of Mitterrand there, or excuse me, Mitterrand's mistress and wife there at the funeral, connect for us. Is there a connection for us?
I think there's a connection. I think, first of all, there's the recognition that love is important. The French would say the most important thing in life. And that love, as far as the French are concerned, is embedded in the flesh. And I use a statistic at the beginning of my book to indicate that even middle-aged and older people in France expect to have sex as a part of a radiant love life, whereas Americans, according to this particular poll, don't insist upon the sexual part of the relationship in a love affair to the same extent.
In fact, was this a poll where Americans were asked, do you need sex in an ongoing relationship? And what, about 80% of them said not necessarily, whereas only 30% of the French said that?
Exactly. And if you think of the stereotypical picture of the French in a French movie, which still continue to insist that love is important, the stereotypical picture is of lovers in bed. You see their bodies. It's not just sexual or erotic, but it's very sensual. And the sensual part of French life is important, whether it's sex, food, wine, or fashion. These are all parts of the French sense of identity.
Or even French kissing, I mean, which involves tongues and all of that. I mean, it is a different culture than ours, our puritanically based culture. And that point kept coming through to me over and over again in reading your book. And I was remembering an interview we did with Pamela Druckerman about what the bringing up bébé, what the French can teach us about child rearing. And the French have a good deal to teach us, I think, is your point about, well, carnality, romance, love.
They certainly have a wider view of what constitutes love than we have, and assume that they're going to be, that it's going to have a dark side as well as a sunny side. Suffering, jealousy, multiple partners, even some forms of violence are more acceptable in France than in this country.
Violence, and yet you kind of avoided the Marquis de Sade, among others, in the story of O and those things.
I did avoid the Marquis de Sade because I can't stand him. He makes me sick. And so I just didn't want to go into the Marquis de Sade, although some of my friends say I was a sissy and that he would have certainly been instrumental in the relationship between sex, love, and evil. But I couldn't do it. I never have been able to read him.
You couldn't pull the trigger, as we say.
L'Histoire d'eau, yes, perhaps I should have. And as we know, although it was published under a male name, it was written by a woman, Pauline Réage. And obviously, with another book that I haven't read, is it 50 Shades of Grey?
They're comparing that to the story of Owen.
Yes, indeed. The idea that some women, as well as some men, get pleasure out of sadistic forms of sex. But I didn't go there in this book. Believe me, I had an embarrassment of riches. And it was easy enough, for me at least, to turn my back on sadism and masochism.
I want to talk about those embarrassment of riches, but I couldn't also help thinking about the Petraeus scandal with Paula Bridewell and his wife being quoted as being beyond furious, whereas the French still have this kind of double standard. I know it's changed through the years, but dalliances are almost expected, and I mean, it may be true of Italians too. It's just much more open to that. Like I said, Mitterrand's funeral, there was a wife and mistress.
And the children from both unions. Yeah, certainly. The French take a very different view of adultery. In fact, the earliest myths of the 12th century are tales of adultery. But notice in the literature, the more common trio is the wife, her husband, and her lover. So the women get their revenge. And they are perhaps on a much more equal status with the men than couples in other countries. I was amused, greatly amused, when David Brooks said on radio and on television that he took a French view of the Petraeus affair. And when he was asked a day or two later, did he still hold that view, he said, Uber French.
Well, I think what happened to General Petraeus happened, I mean, in terms of his being compelled to resign, happened largely because he's the head spook, you know. I mean, it could have been used against him. But in France, that would not necessarily have been the case. I mean, if he were the head of intelligence, he wouldn't necessarily have had to risk that position or have been blackmailed.
I don't know that. I can't answer that question. But certainly every French president whom I have known, going back to Giscard d'Estaing, all had mistresses and ended up writing about their – some of them wrote about their mistresses in their memoirs. Jacques Chirac certainly had more than one woman during his long marriage. And his wife said she put up with it for the children, but also because she knew he couldn't get along without her. So I think one of the things we have to realize is that the French do a great deal to hold on to their marriages and to their families. And in some ways, having an affair or two or more for both men and for women sometimes acts as a safety valve. I have known many women who have had affairs and have told me about them, and even their mothers have known about those affairs. I'm not saying it's good or it's bad. It's simply a different attitude towards adultery. And even when Clinton was having his troubles, I can remember a woman standing up in the French equivalent of the French Parliament. This woman was arch-conservative, an enemy of gays and abortion and even contraception. And she said of Clinton, "What? This is a man who loves women. It just shows that he has a great libido." Well, you can't imagine that in this country.
No, in fact, they said that about Dominique Strauss-Kahn. But, I mean, in France, not necessarily in this country, because it was, of course, a question of force and all that. But I'm struck by the fact that he has now been sued for divorce. And things changed even in France after the Republican period. I mean, they began to look more toward marriage as, well, as Americans do, I guess, as a monogamous institution, or what at least should be a monogamous institution. Didn't I mean, you point that out.
Yes. I just want to say one more word about Dominique Strauss-Kahn. He went beyond the pale. And his wife, who was a very well-known journalist, came from a wealthy family. She's a lovely person. She'd had enough. He embarrassed her, and beyond embarrassment, it was humiliating for her. And she tried to stay in that marriage, but ultimately could not.
Well, forgive me. You think the reason the marriage has been so inviolable for the most part may have to do with the Catholicism, in part at least?
Dominique Strauss-Kahn.
Well, no, he was Jewish.
I see. But, yes,
you know,
he and
in
she
France
were
in
Jewish,
general, yeah.
I think Catholicism has certainly something to do with it in that marriage is supported to a very great extent, and divorce among Catholics is not acceptable, as we know. It's condemned. That may have something to do with it, but there are a lot of other issues that have to do with the importance of family. That is, again, going back to the 12th century, in that marriages were often arranged. They were often issues of uniting people of the same rank and of the same fortunes. And so marriages were thought of more as obligations. You don't marry just the other person. You marry the family. Two families marry. And out of that situation, particularly, as I've said, in the 12th century, the idea of love often became separated from the idea of marriage.
Until courtly love.
Yes, during courtly love, the idea of marriage between a man and a woman was something that had to endure, but love was something that existed outside of marriage, the knight and his lady, be it Guinevere or Isolde. And at some of the courts of the 12th century, where you had love trials, the decision was, love can't exist between husband and wife because it can't be a spontaneous affair.
Talking with Marilyn Yalom, her new book, How the French Invented Love. I had mentioned that things kind of changed at the end of the Republican period, the end of the 18th century.
Well, things were always changing. There never is a moment in which a change becomes definitive. But certainly during the French Revolution, you get a different vision of what love and marriage are. This is a bourgeois ideal that women in particular marry as virgins and they stay monogamous for the rest of their married life, that marriage is something that a man and a woman choose themselves. So you get more the romantic ideal, but you choose that marriage on the basis of a certain concept of citizenship. In order to be good citizens and to raise your children as good citizens, you need to be married and you need to live up to certain Republican ideals.
And you referred before to the revenge of the lesbians. I mean, you write about the lesbians, particularly in Paris before World War II, and also about Proust and his neurotic love, which certainly can be identified with homosexuality or homoeroticism, because Proust was a homosexual. I mean, how does it differ, love, let's say, the love that dare not speak its name, as it was known for so long, at least in the English-speaking world, from heterosexual love?
It's difficult to say how it differs. It probably doesn't differ at all in terms of the intensity, the
passion,
caring,
amour, as you call it.
Yes,
yeah.
Amour, passion. There is certainly evidence that heterosexuals and homosexuals share the same kind of intense longing for the other. But when you read the works of Gide or Proust at the end of the 19th century, they were living in a society in which love could not be public. And when love can't be public, it has all kinds of problems, as we've known, those of us who knew gay men in the 60s and 70s. And the difference today from 100 years ago is so profound. I mean, I know gay men today and lesbian women today who live very much the same way heterosexual couples live, that is, openly and in families. So that is one of the most profound revolutions. The point that I make in my book is that the French were ahead of everyone else in bringing homosexuality out of the closet. Not just Gide and Proust, but also lesbians at the turn of the 20th century who were cutting their hair short and who were wearing pre-flapper type androgynous clothes.
Does this include Gertrude Stein?
Yeah, of course. Why did Gertrude Stein go to Paris before World War I, or was it right after World War I,
right,
and stay
after,
there
yeah.
through the 20s and the 30s? Because that was the place to go if you were a lesbian, and nobody would say anything to you to your face. Of course, people said things behind her back. Now, for example, Hemingway certainly wrote some nasty things about Gertrude Stein, although he enjoyed her largesse while he attended the gatherings at her home. But Colette is a perfect example of the new woman who chooses to marry. Then, because her husband proves flagrantly unfaithful, she gets involved with a woman, a marquise, for about 5 or 6 years. And then she ultimately remarries. But it was in Paris before the First World War that you could do such things, that there were such things as lesbian bars, and that you could live a freer life than almost anywhere in the world if you were gay or lesbian.
And you also have this French paradigm of the older woman and the younger man that you write about, the initiation into the world of sex.
Right. That was a socio-erotic formula that, again, extended back to the Middle Ages. Typically, the woman would marry young, say 15, 16, 17, 18, 20 at the most. By then, she would have been an old maid.
Excuse me, wasn't Eloise, I discovered, only 15?
Yes, Eloise was 15. Her husband was almost 20 years older, if I don't remember the exact figure.
So he was a pedophile by today's standards.
Well, yes. But by the standards of her time, she was a nubile woman. And it was very common for a younger woman to be married to an older man, and she would have her two children, produce an heir and a spare, and then la femme de 30 ans, the woman of 30, had a certain freedom. She had, and I'm of course speaking of women of a certain class, she was then allowed to live her own life, and sometimes that meant taking on a younger lover. Now, the younger lover was 20 or 21 or 22, and where could he find a suitable woman to sleep with? Well, prostitutes or women who were 30 and over. And that's a pattern that has existed right into the 20th century. And I don't know about the 21st. I haven't been checking that out among my younger friends.
We're talking to Marilyn Yellum. Her newest book is How the French Invented Love, 900 Years of Passion and Romance. And you may want to join this conversation. In fact, let me give you an opportunity to do that. We do welcome your questions and comments and welcome you becoming a part of our conversation here on Forum, which is live and interactive. So feel free to join the program. Our toll-free number is available to you now. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your phone calls. Toll free from wherever you're listening or however. 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments you might have on our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And of course, you can also go to our Facebook page or tweet us, and our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. This is instructive, I mean, this book in so many ways, particularly when we contrast it to the kind of American puritanical heritage and tradition and the sense of, I don't know, American ideals of living happily ever after and a relationship that's supposed to feed everybody's needs on both parts and all of those kinds of things. I mean, there's perhaps much to learn from the French, I guess, is really. And it began for you as a kind of adventure. You, young woman out of Wellesley, going to Paris and intoxicated by probably Francophiliac, but also by just this whole world. And it was a world then of, well, this curious paradigm, Sartre and de Beauvoir, who now we know Lanzmann was also a part of that triangle, the man who made the film Shoah. They became almost, in a sense, for contemporary France, a kind of symbol of this ongoing openness of love.
Well, certainly Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir were the most popular, the best-known couple of the 20th century. And when I went to France for the first time as a junior year student, they were in the air. Existentialism was in the air, and we looked for them. I and my sister and fellow students, we looked for them around Saint-Germain-des-Prés. I, at that point, never saw Simone de Beauvoir, though I had contact with her later in life. And, of course, what they were saying then was shocking for Americans, because they were saying that a couple could have a primary relationship that was to last for life, whether it was within marriage or outside of marriage, but you could also have what they called contingent relationships.
Or Plato's Retreat, they used to call them secondary and tertiary relationships.
Exactly. And so what we knew of Sartre and de Beauvoir is that the two of them were committed to one another, but that they were allowed to have affairs outside of that relationship, which they indeed did. Unfortunately, later on, we came to know a lot more about that couple, and some of the third parties didn't have such a good time of it. I got to know a woman named Bianca Lomblin. And in fact, I was responsible for having her book translated into English. And she was not well treated by Sartre or Simone de Beauvoir after each had had an affair with her. So sometimes you have to, as I did, reappraise the philosophy and the lives of people whom you have admired.
Let's go back, though, to just what you perceive as the invention of love and what we've learned from the French and what perhaps we continue to learn, and what some people feel maybe is not worth learning. I mean, the sense, for example, you draw this comparison of the British, not necessarily known for their sensuality or, you know, more for their stiff upper lip and everything. They studied the Brontes, let's say, or read the Brontes. Almost no sex, really, in the Brontes. I mean, a lot of it titillating underneath the surface. But then you contrast that to the fact, and this is one of the most shocking things to me in reading your book, Dangerous Liaisons is required reading in high school in France.
Yes. All French students, if they want to pass their baccalaureate, have to read Les Liaisons Dangereuses in their last year of high school. Now, that is one of the most wickedly erotic books you will ever read. If you haven't read it, perhaps you've seen it in one of its various film
versions.
How many
movies have been made of it?
Yeah, in fact, there's one in Chinese right now that I'm dying to see. It takes place in Shanghai, I believe, during the 20s. But the characters who represent pre-revolutionary Ancien Régime aristocracy are really vicious characters, a marquise and a vicomte, and they live for pleasure. They live for sensual and sexual pleasure, and they go from one partner to the next in serial relationships. The only thing that they're concerned about is that they don't get to be the ones who are dumped. Now, this is an immoral book. And I think that what students are expected to take away from this is the very idea that such behavior is immoral and also can lead to catastrophe, which it does.
Students may have been part of the Vichy government. We won't even go there, though. I mean, in terms of what is learned from... Well, feel free to join this conversation again. How the French Invented Love, Marilyn Yellen, the author here with us. Our toll-free number available to you, 866-733-6786, or email forum@kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Marilyn Yellen, who for many years has been with Stanford, not only as a professor of French, but now as a member of the university's Clayman Institute for Gender Research. And her new book is How the French Invented Love, 900 Years of Passion and Romance. I was just thinking about the fact that recently a young woman friend of mine who will remain unnamed, this is her story, her narrative, was at a party in Silicon Valley with a lot of young men of that world, mostly men. In fact, the party was set up to have young women meet young men. And she said, and this attractive young woman, she said all the young women there were attractive. She said, we could have been walking around in our underwear and these guys were looking at their apps and they couldn't look up from the... I mean, the story sounds amusing, but there is something about that that struck me in reading your book about how the French, I mean, in general, there's all this flirtation and sensuality as part of even just the normal, you should forgive me for phrasing it, social intercourse, I mean, as opposed to any other kind, just what men do and what women do.
Well, there certainly is a very different social environment when you're in France. You expect that you will have conversation that is flirtatious. You expect that someone will notice what you're wearing. People whom I've known for years and years and years, and we're talking people in their 60s, 70s, 80s, who will come up and kiss you on both cheeks and tell you how great you look. The man in the street who is sweeping will look up at you and say, "Bonjour, madame," in a way that makes you feel a little more perky. It's just part of the culture.
Well, let's find out what our listeners have to say, and let's bring them into the conversation. Tanya, we begin with you. Good morning.
Good morning. Very interesting conversation, as usual. And I have a couple of questions, and I'm not sure how much you've actually touched upon this, so forgive me if you're going to be repeating yourself at all. But I'm curious about just how acceptable it is for women to have affairs in relationship to men. I mean, in the sense that I understand it's very acceptable for men, and how acceptable is it for women? And my second question, which is different, is that if you don't have affairs, are you perceived as sort of a square and kind of not, you know, just a little bit too conservative and not adventurous, not sexual? Is that actually a hindrance?
Thank you. Both good questions. Forgive me for phrasing it this way, flesh out a little more about women and affairs, Marilyn Yellen.
Well, women usually these days have affairs before their marriage. There's practically no one whom I know of who has been married in the last 30, 40 years who has not slept with her husband beforehand.
It's probably true here in the States as
yes,
well, except
I think
maybe
that,
the South. Or
Yeah, I think that the idea of saving oneself for marriage is not a French idea. Love without sex is not a French invention. Now, affairs after marriage, that's another matter, and that depends so much upon individuals.
Are you square if you don't? That was her question.
No, you're not square if you don't. I know many couples who are monogamous, who at least are publicly monogamous, both the husband and the wife, who seem to love each other, who seem to care for each other. I love a certain kind of flirtatiousness that I see even between husband and wife. So I wouldn't say that the standard is to have affairs, but there is that possibility, and it doesn't necessarily lead to divorce, as it often does in this country.
What about women having affairs? Is there more acceptance, more sort of acquiescence to the idea that it's going to happen to women nearly as much as men?
I would say that women having affairs is as common an idea as it is for men to have affairs. Now, I don't have a statistical answer to that question. But for the 900 years that I write about, the idea that a married woman would take a lover is such a common idea that it's almost banal. If you think of the British novel, you were speaking about British novels earlier, they end with marriage. French novels begin with marriage. Madame Bovary,
Of course. Madame Bovary in this context, though. I mean, it's not necessarily to her advantage.
No, it's not necessarily to her advantage. But I'm just speaking about what is a common myth or topos or idea within a country. And so the idea that a woman would have an affair in marriage is something that is, if not acceptable, at least very common.
Let's go to more of our callers, and we go to San Leandro. George, you're on with us. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Good morning, Michael. Great show, and Professor Yellen, great book. Could she discuss a little bit more Francois Hollande, the president of France, whose government is the first government in French history to give equal numbers of ministerial posts to men and women, and the story about how Hollande was never married to the mother of his children, but then had an affair with a journalist for Paris Match, and she became Holland's new love of his life and became France's first lady.
Yes, indeed. Any of these things would have disqualified him from becoming the president of the United States. It was very common, and still is, in socialist circles for couples not to marry. And so there would have been no onus to his having lived with Ségolène Royal for 20-some years and for them to have had four children together. Now, she did run for... She was the socialist candidate for presidency, for President Ilia 5 years ago, and she lost. And he stayed with her in the same way that many women stay with their husbands through their presidential runs. But after the election, it became known that he had been having an affair with a woman who is considerably younger, 10 years younger. She, too, in a relationship, and I believe she was officially married and had three children, if I'm not mistaken. But she is now the First Lady of France, unofficially, because they have not married. All of these things, as I say, would not be acceptable in this country. But then if you look back at any of the presidents of the past 20 years, probably none of them could have gotten away with the multiple relations that they had in their marriages.
Let me thank the caller. Actually, I'm reading The Patriarch, the new biography of Joseph Kennedy Sr., and it's really pretty astonishing how Rose Kennedy just sort of girded her loins and said, this is natural, you know, Gloria Swanson, all these famous affairs that he had, but he was a constant womanizer. And the same with the son, with John F. Kennedy Jr., and Jackie was accepting toward this. Her father was a philanderer, and he was French, in fact. A lot of this actually can be transposed across the Atlantic when you think about it in certain cases like these. Right?
Yes, well, I would say that they were using a French model. But what is different in France today is that the younger women are more on a par with the men. And sometimes they're not going to put up with philandering when it goes too far, and particularly if it injures the family. And then there's the other aspect, and that is that women in France are more likely to have affairs, particularly if the husband is un coureur, a womanizer. One thing I haven't said in this talk with you, Michael, is that the accent on woman as not only the subject, as the object of a man's desire, but as the subject of her own desire is historically long-lived. If you look at other cultures, you often have a picture of the woman who is desired by a man. You don't often have the picture of the woman who is desiring, but you have that in France. And the idea of la grande amoureuse, the woman who'll give everything for love, that's a French idea. And she's not a freak, whether she's the singer Edith Piaf or other characters whom I've written about.
It's Anna Karenina, too.
Of course,
I mean,
it is.
You know, crosses borders all the time in literature and in life. Let me go to some of the emails here. Listener writes, this is Stephen, the French attitude toward extramarital relationships in some ways sounds wonderful, but the reality that sours the concept, in my view, is sexually transmitted disease, especially the incurable ones such as HIV. That prospect is enough for me to give monogamy to my spouse and expect it from her. Beth writes on our website, having been raised in a French-style home where I was taught by my wise aunt that French seduction is bound tightly with what French call plaisir, or the art of creating and relishing pleasure of all kinds, I appreciate how the French handle the subject of sexuality and how sensuality is found in all things French, from food, art, music, architecture, gardens, and clothing. Seems only fitting they would have the art of sexual pleasure down to an art. Love how the French and even San Franciscans just don't have the Puritan mindset or love-hate relationship with sexuality that so many Americans have. Instead, they see sex and sensuality as a need, as important as eating and sleeping. It's why I believe a wise man who can seduce my mind can seduce my body. And Peter writes on our website, a chicken or egg question. Does the French language sound romantic to us because we associate it with a culture we already think of as romantic? Or is it the sound of the language that makes French culture seem that much more romantic to us?
And that's a hard one to answer, but there is something fluid about the language and fluid, I suspect, about the ease with which men and women relate to each other in France. Not always. I'm not trying to put a rosy glow on all things French, but there is a certain ease, a certain, you use the word plaisir, pleasure. Pleasure is not a word you hear over and over and over again in American and Anglo history, whereas le plaisir is a word that you hear over and over and over again. You're expected to have pleasure.
Not necessarily in a hedonistic sense. But
in a sensual sense, there's nothing wrong with having pleasure. And also in conversation. Michael, you do beautifully in France because you
so
are...
My French is terrible. But
well, you're expected to be able to carry on a conversation. When I was doing research in 19th century Anglo-American and French history of women, I discovered that the manuals for English women said that they should be good listeners. The manuals for French women said you should be able to carry on your end of the conversation. So there's pleasure in conversation. There's pleasure in sex.
Talking again with Marilyn Yellum, and her book is How the French Invented Love, 900 Years of Passion and Romance. Going to go to more calls in just a moment. Recently, I had Mick LaSalle on the program, the San Francisco Chronicle's ace film critic and reviewer. And he's written a book about French actresses, and he essentially operates under the thesis that French films give more human, multidimensional roles to French actresses precisely for the reason that we're talking about here, because it encompasses more of their humanity, including how they can be human in their carnality or in their expression of love, and how that often involves suffering and often involves, you know, perverse kinds of things and experimentation and trial and error and so forth. I think there's a general rule that the French filmmakers represent that much more than, say, any other culture, American filmmakers. Because I'm also reminded of a friend of mine who was involved with a Swedish woman, and she wound up having a relationship with her husband as well as a lover. And it was very open. You know, one week it would be with a lover, one week it would be the husband. And I thought, this probably couldn't go on in the United States, but it could go on in Sweden or France. It's more human, maybe. Maybe they're ahead of us.
Well, all I can say is I do think French films very often give women a more humane picture and a more varied picture than what we get in American films. Now, that's not to put down American films. It's just to say that women play a larger role in film as they do in theater and as they have done, if not politically, in the private realm. Women have been extremely influential in the private and in the cultural realm. And one of the things that happened when I was professor of French at Cal State Hayward, that's what it was called in those days, is that I discovered, oh, it's a long story. I can simply say that there were many more women writers in France going back to the Middle Ages, Marie de France or the 17th century, the author of La Princesse de Clèves, The Princess of Cleves, and the women who ran the salons in the 17th century and the 18th century. These women changed French culture. They had real influence. There was a kind of feminization of culture, and that has stood women in good stead in France.
Yet all the chefs were men, pretty much, weren't they?
Well,
I mean, you think about women doing cooking and all
there
that.
There are women chefs in France to this day, but it wasn't so much that they were in the kitchen. They were in the salons directing the conversations. They were in the guidebooks telling you how to behave in the 17th century. And men were listening and sometimes changing their activities. You had to know how to write a verse if you wanted to woo a lady. And that became as important as learning how to ride a horse.
Well, you use the example of Cyrano, which is a wonderful example of finding the language of love. I mean, he happened to be a ventriloquist, in effect, but he was nevertheless finding that language that won the woman. So necessary to... But here's another point of view. Adriana writes, "My wonderful and very loving French husband says that if the French invented love, French women invented being complicated head cases. He's very happy with his non-game-playing Americans." Thoughts?
Interesting. I talk about a psychiatrist who is French, and his position was, well, of course you have to have mystery in marriage if you want the marriage to continue. You don't want to have two circles that overlap. You want to have circles that intersect. And he says, and this is on the basis of his dealings with his clients and his own experience, if I knew everything about my wife, she would be less interesting to me. And I do think there is a more straightforward, tell it all, let it all hang out attitude that Americans have as compared to French women who want to hold on to a certain mystery. And maybe that's what this gentleman is talking about.
So what are the main reasons, at least, that we can determine behind French divorces? Is it that love fades, or, you know, if you just expect the marital institution and family and all those to stay together for whatever reason and you have affairs on the side, what are the reasons for going to the divorce court usually? Just not getting along and being unavailable and emotionally?
Oh, well, so many different reasons. Life is long. If you marry in your 20s and now you expect...
Well, let me reframe the question. Are they different, you think, than what leads American couples into divorce?
It's very hard to say, to make any kind of a generalization. But I do think that the French today are dealing with some of the same problems that we're dealing with. Women working, their jobs sometimes interfering with their home lives. The adaptations that men are expected to make when children come along, these are problems that the French are facing too, maybe a little bit later than in the United States. But these pose real problems for the French. Also, the midlife crisis. You see that in France as well as here, and it does hit men, it seems, in ways that are different from women. Women, after they are 40, are less prone to ask for divorce, whereas men hitting 50 are more prone to hit divorce. Men feel that they can start all over again. They have the existential possibility of fathering children. And very often that is the time when you see divorce, both in this country and in France.
Again, our guest is Marilyn Yellum. How the French Invented Love is her new book, and our next caller is Catherine from Oakland. Hi, Catherine.
Hello. Hi. Like Marilyn, I was a junior in France, a junior at une année scolaire, and I wanted to ask about the greetings of kissing on the cheek, men and women, and I'll add to that Frenchmen's view of American women. I got the idea my junior year that they thought that American women were kind of easy conquests.
That American women were, I'm sorry?
Easy conquests.
Easy conquests?
Yes.
Oh, that surprises me.
Well, that was the 70s, late 70s.
Yeah, right. That surprises me because I lived at a time when American women were difficult conquests, French women too, as a matter of fact. In those days, the French men would talk about Swedish women as being easy conquests. 70s, it's harder for me to say, except that there was always the position that that American women would stop short of going to bed with you, that they would lead you along, but they preserved their virginity. I can't say how that is today.
It's changed. But we thank you for the call. Actually, here's a listener who says, a few years ago, this is Jeannie, says, I had the opportunity to work in Europe with a number of French colleagues, and I was initially stunned by how easily they would sit and tell me about their wives, children, et cetera, then directly proposition me. I actually found the honesty somewhat refreshing. Another listener, Ernst, says, I'd like to hear real statistical data on this show. My experience with the French is totally different, and I also have seen a number of stats that show Americans to be far more sexually active than the French. But I'd like to hear real statistics as well as cultural references. I expect the difference might be surprising. I don't know if we have necessarily those statistics at our call here, but certainly America's gone through quite a sexual revolution.
Indeed.
And another listener says, since French acceptance of adultery was of aristocratic origin and initially bourgeois marriage was sentimentalized, when did adultery become more acceptable to the middle class? And then another additional question, this is from Diana. Pre-19th century aristocratic women's adultery was more censured and dangerous and had to be much more discreet than men. Their freedom depended partly on their husband's permission, as with Madame du Châtelet and Voltaire. The book Passionate Minds on their relationship is excellent.
Yes, thank you. I want to say one more thing about the difference between the French and the Americans. Sexuality, eroticism, is a stronger current in France than in the United States. And that can be a good thing, and it can also be a bad thing. And I find that Americans who come to France are sometimes bewildered by the openness, such as this man was mentioning, in people telling you about their lives. That is, if you get to know them. They will tell you about their lives. They will tell you about their mistresses. Women will tell you about their lovers. And very often, in the case of the man who reveals his history, it is a come on. So we tend to be less verbally communicative in revealing our life histories to other people. At the same time, there is certainly a lot more sexual activity that goes on. I see things in France today as, well, first there's sex, and then there's a lot of sex, and then people learn how to love. So love is a later stage of the relationship. And this is a big change, both in the United States and in France. You know, how do we deal with this? How do people learn to love? And by that I mean to care for the other person and to allow for that other person to become his or her best self. These are issues that we have not yet been able to address as effectively as I think we need to.
Well, I don't know that you can necessarily learn and advance in what's been called the hookup generation, and a generation that's finds porn pervasive. I mean, the French still have this sensuality so much in the culture, as you point out. Americans are now completely inundated with porn. I mean, it's everywhere on the internet, and doesn't necessarily involve much sensuality. It's just wham bam. You know?
I've always defined porn as sex and violence. Maybe that's a narrow definition of pornography. But pornography as a sensual experience, I suspect that there is that brand in France, as well as the sex and violence. I agree with you that when you look at the situation today in the United States and in France, it's disconcerting. At the same time, there are people who have sex, more sex, and do fall in love with each other and do want to have enduring liaisons and marriages. And so there's still hope for the one true love.
Let's go to more of our calls. We go to you, Elaine. Hi.
Hi. Interesting conversation. Thank you. Excuse me. I just have a couple of questions. I've read that in France, it can be difficult for women in the workplace because of sexual harassment. And the second, another question, I read recently in the paper that regarding the attempts of the present government there to endorse same-sex marriage, that there have been protests in the provinces about this. And the idea I got from reading the article was that the provinces tend to be more conservative, for instance, in the larger cities, mainly Paris. So extrapolating from that, I wanted to know if, indeed, that is the case, that there is more opposition in the hinterlands, and also, as a part of this question, whether or not the provinces, if people would tend to be more conservative in general about marriage, etc. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for the questions. Marilyn Yellen.
Yes, I think that's true, that what you call the hinterlands or what the French call La France profonde does tend to be more conservative. After all, in Paris, the mayor of the city is openly gay. That would be less common in certain parts of France, not in all, but in certain parts of France where the population is more conservative. I want to say, though, that what the French call le pax, a kind of pact between same-sex couples, has become common now for heterosexual couples who don't want to take that final step of marriage. It's a halfway step towards marriage. It started out for same-sex partners, and now it has moved towards the larger population.
We're coming up to the end of this hour, but lower class different in France, the so-called peasant class? You would think in terms of love, I'm thinking of Maupassant and some of those writers, there's a real distinction.
It is certainly different for peasants, but there aren't that many peasants left in France, or for working class. But the French tend to have a trickle-down theory system where what becomes popular amongst the upper classes then is shown in movies.
Thank you, Marilyn Yellen.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.